From Nevada to Massachusetts, Nebraska to Georgia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, 25 states have filed a federal suit to block implementation of President Obama's amnesty plan for illegal aliens. Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. Could congressional Republicans be getting ready to raise gas taxes? Andy Roth has the real story behind funding for the new highway bill. It has been many years since Congress actually passed a federal budget. Eric Boehm and Matt Kittle have a Watchdog Radio report on a proposal to dock the pay of senators and representatives if they don't get the job done on time. And in the aftermath of the fight over the House speakership, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary on why the time has come to focus on what can be done. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Obama's plan to grant de facto amnesty to millions of illegal aliens is not sitting well with the states, 25 of which have filed court action to prevent his plan from taking effect. Hans von Spakovsky is senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. He's here to talk about the suit. Hans, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Hans, of course, President Obama has issued this executive order or orders on immigration. A number of states around the country obviously have a problem with that, as, of course, do many in Washington. But some of the states are taking legal action. Can you tell us a bit about what the states are doing?
Well, after the president made his speech announcing to the nation what he was doing, he had his head of the Department of Homeland Security issue directives implementing his plan. 25 states have now filed a lawsuit against the president and specifically against the Department of Homeland Security, and they are trying to get an injunction, actually, to stop this plan from being implemented.
Let's talk about implementation of the plan, because the president issues an executive order. Probably most folks don't know what happens thereafter. So just in terms of what the mechanics would be, what is the Department of Homeland Security going to be doing?
Well, we need to be careful and make sure everyone understands that the president actually didn't issue an executive order. He didn't issue a written order implementing his plan. What he did instead was he told his secretary, Jay Johnson, who's the head of the Department of Homeland Security, to issue a directive to everyone that works at DHS, telling them, here is what you are now going to do, and here is how you are going to treat illegal aliens in this country. So basically, he's used the administrative executive process to put his plan in place, and they're treating it as if they are, have simply amended the earlier program that they started. You'll recall when Janet Napolitano was the head of DHS, the president put his deferred action plan in for teenagers and others who were in the country illegally. And they're just saying now they are amending that to basically provide deferred action, which really is amnesty, for up to 5 million people who are here illegally. Not only saying we're not going to prosecute you, we're not going to deport you, but they're actually going to be issuing work permits to these individuals.
So we have these 25 states that want to put a halt to this. What is the legal basis of their challenge?
They basically make three claims. The first is that the president is directly violating the Constitution and the part of the Constitution that says that it's the president's duty to take care that our laws are faithfully executed. And they're saying he's not doing that. He is not enforcing and executing our immigration laws. They are also claiming two violations of a federal law. It's called the Administrative Procedure Act. And that's a law that basically says that when a federal agency issues a new regulation, it has to be within their authority to do it. It can't be arbitrary and capricious. And they have to put out any proposed regulation first for public comment so everyone can see it and file comments. They claim none of those things were done and that DHS, Department of Homeland Security, didn't have the authority to do what it is now doing.
In terms of the states that are involved, are these mainly border states? Or with 25 states, I would assume that there are states all across the country involved in this.
Yeah, no one can say that this is just one part of the country that are suing. We have states from everywhere, states in the southeast, states along the border, states in the west, even states in the northeast. Maine, for example, is one of the states that has joined the lawsuit. So this is a very, very broad coalition of states that are suing the administration.
Let's talk for a minute or two, Hans, if we could, about process. In terms of filing this challenge, what court is it before? How will this process unfold as it goes forward?
Well, the states filed this lawsuit down in federal court in Texas. And in fact, they're in the Southern District of Texas, what's called the Brownsville Division. I think they may have filed it down there hoping that they would get a friendlier federal judge assigned to the case. This was filed at the beginning of December. The judge assigned to the case, Andrew Hainan, actually scheduled an injunction hearing for January 9th, because in addition to filing the lawsuit, the states also filed a request for an injunction from the court ordering the president to stop implementing this plan.
Is this the only effort that the states are undertaking, or are they pursuing other avenues to try and block implementation of this policy change or executive order, however you might want to phrase it?
No, this is really the only shot the states have at trying to stop this. They really don't have any other options. I mean, the only other way really that what the president is doing can be stopped is if Congress itself defunds what's going on at the Department of Homeland Security and basically says that no federal monies can be used to implement the president's plan. That has not yet happened.
In terms of Congress, as part of the so-called Cromnibus that was passed here back before Christmas, the funding for some parts of Department of Homeland Security was only passed on a short-term basis. So as we look to this battle over immigration continuing, do you see additional congressional action? Is this going to be something that Congress is going to, in fact, take up over the next few weeks?
Well, they're going to have to. The funding for DHS runs out at the end of February. That's a very short time away. And they are going to have to decide in the continued funding for that department whether they are going to put in language that says that the president's plan cannot be implemented. If they don't do that, if they simply approve regular funding for DHS, well, then the president's plan is going to go forward until and unless a court issues an injunction against it.
We have been talking with Hans von Spakovsky, who is senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. They're, of course, based in Washington, D.C. And Hans, tell us just a bit about the Heritage Foundation. And if we have listeners interested in reading your articles on what the states are doing on immigration and or learning more about it, where can they go on the web to get that information?
Sure. The Heritage Foundation is the largest conservative think tank in the country. We push the ideas of smaller government, more opportunity, economic opportunity for people, less government regulation, less taxes. And our website is heritage.org.
Hans von Spakovsky, senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Hans, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth is, of course, in Washington, D.C., as is now the new session of Congress. Andy, good to have you here.
Hi, thanks for having me, Loman.
Well, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, there was, in fact, a vote for Speaker of the House, and it was not your normal vote. Can you explain to us what happened?
Yeah, there were all sorts of stories to this, a lot of side stories. One, Mario Cuomo passed away recently, and a lot of Democrat House members attended his funeral rather than be present for the speaker vote. So not everyone was voting. And then, of course, a lot of Republicans were disgruntled with Boehner's leadership. So several of them voted against him. At the time, it was unclear how many votes were needed to defeat him. But at the end of the day, I think it was something like 34, 35 were needed. In the end, 25 Republicans stood up and opposed him. So Boehner obviously remained speaker, but I think the lasting mark or the bruise is that there is a fair number of conservatives in the House who are disappointed with Boehner's leadership. And it should be noted, and I think leadership knows this, is that it's not just the 25 who were brave enough to oppose him. There are probably north of 50 who decided that it wasn't worth it for one reason or another, but that we can expect them to be hostile to leadership going forward. One further note I would make about this is that even before the vote was occurring, a lot of members came out and publicly said that they were opposed to Boehner, and swift punishment was brought down on them. Two of them, Daniel Webster and Rich Nugent of Florida, were swiftly booted off the Rules Committee, a prize committee for some. They think it's a prize committee. So the past couple of days, the headlines have been about how Boehner and leadership are going to exact severe punishment on the rebels. When they did that, a lot of the conservatives who voted against him, plus a lot of conservatives who voted for Boehner, got angry with this and said that punishment will only fuel the fire and make Boehner's job even worse. So now leadership is in a position where they can't deliver the punishments that they want. They're in a corner. If they deliver punishment, there's going to be a rebellion. And if they don't deliver punishment, then the rebels will be emboldened to deliver more opposition to the leadership. So it's a tough spot for leadership. And frankly, it's one that they deserve because they have continually not listened to conservatives in the House. So hopefully in the next few weeks, things will get repaired and conservatives will be able to extract some concessions from leadership on how they govern going forward.
Speaking of governing going forward, this leadership battle and all the repercussions that are now taking place in its aftermath, what does this portend for the success of this Congress going forward if it's starting out on such a bad footing?
Republicans are really in a mess right now, and it's because they've got bad leadership. I don't even think they know what to do because, on the one hand, they are being told by conservatives that we need to offer a bold agenda, but their more moderate members and themselves, frankly, want to convince the public that they can govern, which is usually code for being bipartisan and passing large spending bills in order to placate some constituency. And their desire is to assuage voters in such a way that they can win the 2016 election. And that's what's really disappointing, is that immediately after winning the election, their end goal is to win the next one, not to grow the economy, increase the standard of living, or reduce the size of government. So we've got our work as fiscal conservatives cut out for us. We've got to figure out a way for leadership to do the right thing, even though they don't believe it's the right thing. So we're making inroads. The best thing I can say is that with each election, we're adding more conservatives to both chambers of Congress, and we'll just continue to do so until we have a conservative majority in both.
One area of concern among many here, Andy, is the highway bill. The funding for highways will expire later this year. There's talk of a gas tax increase. Are Republicans planning to go along with this?
Well, it's funny because a lot of Republicans claim that they're conservative, and the first thing they point to is infrastructure, to roads. And they think that if they spend a ton of money on roads, that it will increase commerce. And by increasing commerce, you're increasing the private sector. Ergo, they are fiscally conservative. That's why, unfortunately, the highway bill is very, very popular for both Republicans and Democrats. Several Democrats, like Nancy Pelosi and Dick Durbin from Illinois, have come out and boldly said, let's increase the gas tax. That's easy for them to do because they're Democrats. What's startling and unfortunate is that there are a lot of Republicans who are saying quite subtly that they're open to a gas tax as well. The language they speak, the rhetoric, does not explicitly say that, but they basically are allowing a gas tax to be discussed. They're saying things like, all things need to be on the table when talking about revenue for highway spending. So it's startling what we're hearing. Again, right after an election, we're hearing that Republicans will entertain a gas tax increase. But it is what's currently going on, and we've got our work cut out for us on how we're going to stop it.
Let's talk for a second about the politics of a gas tax hike. Of course, we all know Republicans got swept into power in the U.S. Senate in the past election. One of the main themes of that election was reeling in government, not making it bigger. What does it do, Andy, to the Republican brand if Republicans join with Democrats for a major tax hike?
Well, I think Republicans are deluding themselves into thinking that a gas tax is one of the easier taxes to raise without getting the ire of voters against them. Obviously, it's not a good idea. I mean, the gas tax affects everyone, not just the top 1%. And it makes everybody's budgets more expensive, prevents people from saving for college and other things. Despite whatever belief Republicans have that everyone loves roads and better roads and no potholes and so on and so forth.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, tell us just a little bit about the club.
Sure thing. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 100,000 members from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union. And we're united because we believe in economic liberty, lower taxes, limited government. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, looking forward to talking with you again next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
No budget, no pay. That is a proposal kicking around the halls of Congress, which for years now has failed to pass a federal budget. Eric Boehm is joined by Matt Kittle for this Watchdog Radio Report.
It's been more than 5 years since Congress has passed a federal budget, but with the new session beginning this week, Republicans now in control of both the House and the Senate, I suppose hope springs eternal in Washington, D.C. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Watchdog Radio. Thanks for joining us here on American Radio Journal. My guest today is my colleague and friend Matt Kittle. He's a national reporter for Watchdog.org. Matt, thanks for being here. Congress back in session this week, and I suppose you know we can start to already think ahead about the budgeting process there. And it seems like there's some members of Congress who want to kind of put a gun to their own heads when it comes to finally getting a federal budget passed.
Yeah, I love this. This is, again, kind of like, you remember the whole debt ceiling battle, and they needed this system in place where if they didn't get something accomplished, it was I don't remember how they phrased it, but it was this deadly thing that if they didn't get something accomplished, then something draconian was going to happen, at least in the eyes of some analysts who watch this. And again, you've got the House and the Senate, members of the House and the Senate, saying, we can't do this on our own. We need some legislation to tell us, amped up legislation to tell us, we have to do what is, in essence, our number one job, and that is to put together a budget.
So on one hand, and of course we're talking about this no pay without a budget bill that some Republicans are floating, on one hand I think this seems like a good idea. If Congress doesn't do their job, and one of the big parts of their job is to pass a budget, if they don't do their job, yeah, they shouldn't get paid. That makes a lot of sense. On the other hand, it seems like, as you were just talking about, this is just another kind of trumped up, it's not necessarily a crisis in the way that the debt ceiling or the default would be a crisis, but just another trumped up way to make members of Congress do the thing that they should be doing anyway. I mean, we're paying them to be there. They should be doing this regardless.
Just a little history. Back in 2013, we saw the No Budget, No Pay Act put in place, too. And everybody in Congress seemed to love the idea. It had overwhelming bipartisan support. The president signed it. But what happened is it became so watered down that it didn't look anything like it was. You know, the original bill, like this bill, had a provision that said, you don't get your job done, you don't have a budget in place on time, you don't get paid, and none of this stuff is, your pay is not waiting for you. You just simply don't get paid. What happened in the last version of this is they put this money in an account, and if they hadn't accomplished a budget by April 15th of that year, it's not like they wouldn't eventually get paid. The money would have just been frozen, and then eventually they would have gotten paid. This bill says you don't get paid at all. You know, the longer you wait to get this accomplished, the less you get paid in your annual salary, basically. The version that passed and, you know, that eventually became law in 2013 didn't say that they had to come together with a reconciled full process budget. So basically what you had is you had two distinctly different budgets. Obviously, we know what the budget looked like on the Democrat-controlled Senate side, and obviously we know what the budget looked like on the Republican-controlled House side. And, of course, they never did find common ground. They were two distinctly different budgets, and nothing got done.
Nothing got done, but everybody got paid. And I think you make a good point there. I mean, what I want to see is I want to see total it all up, not just members of Congress, but all their staff, everybody. Every week that there's not a budget passed, that amount of money goes back to the American public. I don't care if they're cutting me a check for 50 cents. I mean, I don't care. I want that money back. That would be a real thing. Or you'll put that money towards paying down the national debt, something like that. Holding it in escrow until we pass a budget, that's really a toothless provision, I think. But, yeah, look, okay, we've got a couple minutes left here with Matt Kittle, national reporter for Watchdog.org. Matt, we've already seen some drama just this week as Congress reconvened, some drama in the House over whether John Boehner would get to be Speaker of the House. He ended up winning despite some dissension there. We've got Republican control of the House and Senate. Does that mean we'll finally get that budget that won't be completely different? There might be some chance of reconciling the two sides and maybe getting something finished?
The short answer is no.
Come on,
and that's what's so frustrating and, you know, preposterous about it all is that, first of all, at the end of it all, you've got the huge, massive, powerful veto tool that's out there from the president. So there was going to be resistance there, obviously. And along the way, you've got to do something that is going to be veto-proof. You know, you've got to put together in both the Senate and the House something that is going to be veto-proof. Now, that doesn't mean that you sell out your principles for compromise to try to get a budget bill done, and that'll be the argument as this moves forward. But, yeah, I mean, you have a divided executive and a divided legislature right now in terms of the power and control with the purse strings in the hands of the Republicans, but the control of the executive in the hands of the top Democrats. So you're still going to have these battles going on now instead of just the inner battles between the House and the Senate. You've got it between the full Congress and the president.
Yeah, and so we continue to go down the road that we've been on for a few years now of Congress. I don't know, maybe they can kind of get their act together and maybe negotiate some things with the White House. But, hey, you know, I think no budget, no pay sounds like a great idea. I just worry that every moment that Congress spends debating that legislation is a moment they're not doing something that would actually matter, something that would affect more than just their own ranks. That is Matt Kittle, national reporter for Watchdog.org. Matt, appreciate you joining us, talking about the no budget, no pay proposal in Congress. Maybe there'll finally be a federal budget this year. We'll stay on top of all of that. You can check us out at Watchdog.org. Keep up to date with everything on Facebook and Twitter at WatchdogORG. For Watchdog Radio, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch us right back here next week on American Radio Journal.
House Speaker John Boehner survived a conservative attempt to oust him from the top job. Now the question is, can Republicans work together to get something accomplished? Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA weighs in on this American Radio Journal commentary.
What should conservatives do now that Republicans have majorities in both the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate? Let me say at the outset that I am not equating conservatives and Republicans. Far from it. But there is a conservative core in the Republican Party that is large enough that the establishment leadership cannot and should not ignore it. So how should it be deployed? I spent 2 weeks in Washington this week meeting with conservative leaders and legislators and attending numerous receptions for members of the 114th Congress. They're not unified, and there's nothing that the left-leaning mainstream media loves more than stories of Republican factionalism and infighting, actively trying to bring the fight out of the caucus rooms and into the open where public opinion is affected. Look how they played up the ill-advised and worst-planned last-minute challenge to John Boehner's speakership. I have a simple plea to citizen activists, commentators, and party leaders alike. Let's keep one eye on the future and the other eye on the American people. That leaves no eye left to focus on ourselves. Can we do that just this once and see if it works? I'm really quite serious. If neither John Boehner nor Mitch McConnell is exactly the kind of leader we might find ideal, they are who we have, and we ought to get behind them instead of taking shots at them. The Republican Party has a rare opportunity to contrast its leadership of Congress with the heavy-handed, dictatorial, and obstructive style of Harry Reid in the Senate and the dysfunctional pass-it-to-see-what's-in-it style of Nancy Pelosi in the House. Republicans now have the chance to pass bills that are genuinely popular with the American people, but that may not be supported by this president. That's perfect. Let him be the one who is out of step with the public. That will set the stage for a positive presidential campaign in 2016, as well as a defense of the GOP majority in what will be a much tougher year than 2014. That means passing one or two easy bills, like the Keystone Pipeline, but also tougher, more complex ones, like a workable border security bill, trimming back the regulatory overreaches of the Obama administration by using the Congressional Review Act the way it was intended, unshackling the burdens on small business in particular, focusing on economic growth rather than government job creation programs, and progress towards tax reform that results in a simpler, fairer system of taxation than the current tax code that is so complex and so riddled with special deals for special interests that no ordinary citizen with average intelligence can even begin to understand it. Every one of those initiatives enjoys wide public support, and every one of them can be supported by conservatives and moderates alike. They're all consistent with Boehner and McConnell's agenda as well, and as citizen activists, let's not fall into squabbling factions that oppose incremental progress because it's not bold enough. Let's limit our legislative ambitions to those issues that are supported by 60% or more of the public. And if most of those are opposed by the president, so much the better from a political standpoint. That's the long game, and that's the game strategy that we, as activists, should be supporting. Obama's overreaches gave us the Tea Party in 2010. Harry Reid's overreach with the nuclear option helped give Republicans the Senate in 2014. Let's not fall into the same trap. Let's not push conservatives to overreach in the new Congress. It may hurt, it may seem like giving in to the establishment, but let's apply some discipline. One eye on the public and one eye on the future. Fight with Boehner and McConnell quietly, if you must, through internal communications, not through public charges of surrender. Then we will set the stage for getting control of the White House as well as the Congress. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on over 200 public affairs-minded radio stations in 45 states across the country. They include WHLM-AM in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, WSWH-FM in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, and WKCT-AM in Bowling Green, Kentucky. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.